I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views. On this edition of Parallax Views, in light of renewed concerns around policing and mass incarceration in America, is there a relationship between feminism and the carceral state that has been overlooked? That's the premise of the new book, The Feminist War on Crime, The Unexpected Role of Women's Liberation in Mass Incarceration by University of Colorado Boulder Professor of Law Aya Gruber. Aya's book tackles that question and provides some provocative answers. Aya joins us on this edition of the program to discuss the often overlooked relationship between feminism and the carceral state. And with that being said, let's get right to the conversation with Aya Gruber, author of The Feminist War on Crime, The Unexpected Role of Women's Liberation in Mass Incarceration. Welcome to Parallax Views. Aya Gruber, author of The Feminist War on Crime, The Unexpected Role of Women's Liberation in Mass Incarceration. That is a mouthful for a title and sure to be controversial with some folks.
Yeah, the title has gotten some pushback from people who are assuming that I am saying that the entirety of the prison system is feminist fault, which is definitely not what I'm saying. But I am definitely saying that there has been this very notable and interesting connection between feminism and, you know, the American penal state, which is really a pretty exceptional institution in the world, like in terms of its size and severity. But that there's been this notable relationship that most people haven't seen. And it's important that they see it because, you know, every so often we have resurgence of these punitive, you know, movements within feminism to really just sort of use the tools of criminal law. So that was really my intention. And I think, you know, it's hard to put all those caveats in a title, even though the title's really long.
You know, it's interesting. When I introduced a friend of mine to the book, they took issue with the title, but it was for sort of a different reason. They said, well, why is it the feminist war on crime? Isn't there like different strands of feminism? It's not like feminism is a monolith. And it got me to thinking about maybe we should define terms a little by what we mean when we say feminism, because I think for a lot of people, it's just become sort of a buzzword.
No, I totally agree with that. There, you know, I do not know how I would describe the relationship between these powerful women's groups who were concerned with women as a category, right, of people, as a group, even though, you know, they're diverse, obviously, like such a diverse group. But I don't know how I would describe the relationship of these powerful groups to the prison state without using the term feminism, right? So, the title would be even longer. And you know, people could take issue with the term prison. Do you mean the entire carceral complex of policing? And, you know, so like you could take issue with any term, right?
I was going to say, I mean, it wouldn't have the same, spike to it if you said, oh, the war of some feminists or this kind of feminist on crime.
Right. No, it's really interesting because feminism is not a monolith, right? And I say that very early on in the introduction. And in fact, I call at some point the feminist war on crime a feminist civil war, because from nearly the very beginning, there was intense internal rifts within feminism. So you take the point in time where you have Seneca Falls and the very birth of feminism. Well, there were black-white rifts, right? And so when you have the suffrage movement, you have some of the white feminists within the suffrage movement, you know, really using racialized arguments, saying, well, black men have the vote. How is it, you know, that savages have the vote and we don't? Well, of course, you know, black women or women who are more aligned with women of color within the suffrage movement, that was a huge internal rift, right? So feminism has never been a monolith. We usually think of feminism as sort of second wave national organization of women, you know, women to work, my body, you know, myself, feminism, right? We have that image in mind. But even back then, during the birth of second wave feminism, we had very different feminists with very different commitments, you know, clashing, collaborating. So, for example, we had socialists versus people who were very committed to the market, right? And entering that market and getting market power. We had black feminists who didn't feel that they could be, for example, separatists because they had to ally with black men against white supremacy. We had women who glorified homemaking, right? These cultural feminist type versus the ones who considered staying at home to be like a form of slavery, right? So feminists have never been a monolith group. But I will say this, there is a certain commitment that unites all feminism. And that is the idea that there is a meaningful category, woman. Now it might be by social construction, it might be by performativity, but it is a meaningful category in a sense that through time, belonging to this category has been a site of subordination, right? So, you know, maybe not the only site, we don't want to essentialize, but a site of subordination. So that's one thing. And I will say this about the book. Powerful groups of feminists, right, who were trying to fight the patriarchy, who were trying to fight for women's power, over and over again, allied with criminal law and criminal law actors over the objections from other feminists within the movement and people outside of the movement. So there is this pattern. It's not all feminists, right? It was in very many ways a civil war. But the reason I say the feminist war on crime is I think that this movement over time to criminal law was so trenchant and so important that today many people automatically associate being feminist with being punitive. For example, if you say, wow, rape and sexual violence is a problem, right? That's like a feminist statement. Sexual violence is a problem. It's a problem for individual women. It's a problem of women's subordination. People will automatically say, well, what's your proposal to get tougher on rape? How are we going to prosecute these rapists? How are we going to, you know, how are we going to make sure that people report to the police? That's an automatic connection, right? And that has come through, you know, decades of time of this alliance. And what I want to do in my book is untether the feminist agenda, the anti-violence agenda, the anti-subordination agenda from this idea that the way you vindicate that agenda is through, you know, throwing in a lot of masculinist police officers and putting people in jails, which are sites of sexual violence. Like, I want to untether that.
No, I guess the other part of the title that I wanted to define, not so much, you know, mass incarceration. I think people know what that means. But I think a lot of times in sort of academic discourse or activist discourse, we'll say things like the prison industrial complex or the carceral state. And it's funny, I always think of my mom, because once in a while she'll listen to my show and she'll say, what does that mean? What does prison industrial complex mean? Or what does the carceral state means. So I'm always trying to maybe explain things for a lay audience. Maybe you could explain that aspect of.
No, it's really interesting how these terms become part of the lexicon or not. I remember about 10 years ago. I mean, it was only 10 years ago. I presented a paper to a law faculty with the word neoliberal in it, which is not, you know, and a couple of members of the faculty were like, what's this jargon, you know, neoliberalism. So now, you know, it's very much a situation where, you know, that's part of at least the academic lexicon. Carceral, I think, is increasingly becoming part of people's understanding. And the way it differs from just saying, oh, the criminal system or prisons, is it is broader, right? So it includes all the ways in which we bring the state to bear in a punitive way. So that could include policing, prosecution, the prison, right? People under penal supervision. And what people don't realize is, yeah, we have the world's largest prison population, but by far we have the world's largest population under penal supervision. So like one little crime can add to a probation that was violated that basically has you under supervision for life. So we have so many people under year or years long or lifetime supervision by the government. So it's all of that. And carceral can even encompass logics, right? So the logic that the way you solve social problems or even address individual harm is necessarily through punishment, discipline, shaming, and pain. So for example, with the campus rape crisis, you know, there's been a lot of discussion of the college disciplinary process against mostly male, you know, respondents, mostly, you know, men and boys who are accused of sexual misconduct. Well, that has also been called carceral because the sense of it is a punitive, top-down, state-centric way of dealing with this issue of, you know, sexual misconduct in college. So when people say something like carceral feminism, they can mean everything from feminists who are actually like, I want life sentences for street harassment, like really, you know, super pro tough on crime, to feminists who actually reject broadening the actual prison state, right? Like broadening the amount of people under penal supervision, but still in sort of civil and administrative ways, really want to be punitive in addressing these various sexist problems. So I think that's what carceral means. It's a range of meanings, but it means something broader than just, you know, even, you know, tough on crime. It means a certain way of thinking and dealing with governance, right? Dealing with how the government is going to address problems that implicate women's equality.
Now, in regards to how you ended up writing this book, and I know you've gone over this and other interviews, but I always find it a really interesting aspect of things because, you know, there's a lot of millennial women today that are very interested in questioning sort of the carceral state, especially in light of Black Lives Matter. There's a lot of questioning going on right now in our culture. And at the same time, you also have that sort of feminist side of things that can sort of be punitive at times. And you had your own experience of dealing with a sort of dilemma, as you put it.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I think, you know, it's always important when you're critiquing, right, a group of people, and I think this is in many ways a critique of certain powerful groups of feminists, to come from a place of generosity. Like, I consider myself a feminist, and I was in this dilemma, and I really did believe that sexual and gender violence was sort of the linchpin of women's subordinated status. So it was this very, like, what we call in, you know, sort of feminist speak, a dominance feminist view, right? That crime and sort of this fast violence against women is really sort of key to women's unequal status. You know, since then I've revised that view, and I think that that's too simple a view, it's too essentialist a view, and it's, you know, women's subordination, and especially depending on who the woman is, totally overdetermined. There's so many factors. But at least growing up, you know, I did have this sense from the movies and just from a lot of things that sexual subordination, rape, the threat of rape, the threat of gender violence was this, you know, huge site of women's subordination. And at the same time, I grew up with a real skepticism of the state's ability to detain people. And part of the reason why was my mother was detained in World War II, you know, on the basis of her race, because she was Japanese, and that was, you know, sort of a racist program made during an actual war, right? So the war rhetoric. So I had these two competing instincts all the way through going to law school. You know, I also had personal experiences with like sexual abuse. And so, you know, I had these instincts. I totally knew I wanted to be a public defender. That was it. That was my goal. I was interning at the public defenders from 15 years old. I wanted to protect the most marginalized, you know, the poorest people, people who could not afford an attorney, against the state that just was so intent on inflicting pain on them. But at the same time, I had this dilemma because I was completely horrified at the thought that I would defend a rapist or like somebody accused of domestic violence. And it was crazy because, you know, the vast, vast majority of these domestic violence cases, they are misdemeanors. And it caused me more concern that I might have to defend a misdemeanor than defending a murderer. Right? Because one implicated what I considered to be the source of women's subordination. So even when I was back in law school, I wrote about this feminist defense attorney dilemma, like whether you could be a good feminist and stand up for the real bad guys, right? Not just people who commit crimes, but like oppressors.
Do you think we sort of saw that a little bit last month? I know it's sort of receded into the background and there's a lot of questions about the accusations made, but with the whole Tara Reid accusations against Joe Biden, it seemed like for a second there, you know, there was like a sort of, oh, this is a dilemma for me moment.
Yes. So I think that is part of the dilemma, right? So part of the dilemma is if you're going to adopt these feminist, right, quote unquote feminist ideologies, like always unconditionally believe the victim or make it really easy to convict somebody, whether in trial or in the court of public opinion. And then, you know, they're done, right? Those are what we would consider to be carceral feminist ideologies. If you have that ideology, you're going to find yourself in a dilemma with your more maybe democratic liberal sensibilities, right? So you're going to end up putting people in jail. You're going to end up casting the net so wide that you have to believe anybody who comes up and makes an accusation, so long as it's an accusation of a sexual nature and it's a woman. And so you're going to have to cancel a lot of, you know, your allies, right? So this is exactly the crux of that dilemma. Feminism tells me I have to be carceral. You know, I have to be punitive. I have to be canceling in this space. I can't be questioning the evidence, right? I can't be weighing the equities here. I have to be pretty absolute in that space. Can I do that and also be a liberal thinker and actor, right? A liberal questions presumptions. A liberal doesn't like top-down punishment or groupthink, right? So that's the kind of dilemma that I was feeling, right? Like, can I be a good feminist and, you know, defend Joe Biden, right? Like I was defending my clients, but, you know, be questioning of Tara Reid, right? So it's a similar type of dilemma. And, you know, what I found pretty quickly after practicing in a domestic violence court was that it wasn't all that much of a dilemma, because this idea that somehow gender justice and women's empowerment in helping women survive, right, the circumstances of the life, especially the women that I was dealing with in Washington, D.C. as a public defender, people who had multiple issues, only one of which was the violence that they were feeling in their family. So this idea that helping those women came sort of exclusively through throwing the partner in jail, you know, I was disabused of that notion early on. You know, with what I saw in domestic violence court. And what I saw in domestic violence court was, you know, a really revolving door of incarceration and despair for the most marginalized people, including women. I saw the women arrested. I saw women, you know, call the police for help and then trigger this penal machine, and it made the spouse deportable. I saw women, you know, begging judges to lift stay away orders that they didn't lift, or just violating them, just violating them. So this idea that prosecution was a panacea, that evaporated so quickly that, you know, after becoming a professor for 20 years, I worked on why I believed it so strongly and why people continue to believe it so strongly, like this connection between vindicating feminist gender justice goals and putting people in jail, right? Like it pretty quickly cleared up for me. And, you know, and then with writing this book, I got really interested in how we got here as feminists. Not all feminists, and a lot have been anti-carceral from the beginning, but most of them have not been. Most of us, I should say, have not been anti-carceral from the beginning. Even somebody whose parent was imprisoned by the government wasn't anti-carceral in that space. And that is pretty darn uniquely American too.
You know, I want to get into that history a bit, but it's always been interesting to me. I think you mentioned that some of the ideas you had as a feminist, and I know I shouldn't say had, you still consider yourself a feminist, but some of the ideas maybe you had when you were first getting involved in law with regards to feminism about incarceration were in conflict with maybe these more liberal ideas, right? And you also mentioned the whole canceling allies thing. That brought to mind the fact that I think at times there's been some strange alliances within feminism. I think of Andrea Dworkin in particular, and I have certain sympathies for Dworkin on some things, but I always found it interesting that she wrote that book, I believe it was called Right Wing Women, and she sort of had alliances with the Christian far right in this country. There does seem to be times where the feminist movement has allied with really reactionary elements of society.
Yeah, I mean, although, you know, in fairness to feminism and even the most sort of radical, what we call dominance feminists, because the basis for dominance feminism is the idea that men's domination of women, right, is the most perfect form of subordination, more than Marxist, you know, capital, you know, labor, more than race, more than this is the most perfect form of subordination. And the way it's primarily achieved is through sexual exploitation. That is sort of the extreme nutshell version of dominance feminism. So yes, within that space, Andrea Dworkin, Catherine MacKinnon, when they were trying to ban pornography, you know, found these alliances with the moral Christian right and the Jerry Falwell, who were also trying to ban pornography for moralistic reasons. And that sort of Christian anti-sex, feminist anti-sex alliance goes way back to the very origins of feminism, when in the, you know, late 19th century, you had feminists largely being these temperance reformers who were against sex and alcohol and vice, and they were for middle-class Christian morality. But they were also very concerned about the fact that, you know, women, and especially poor women that were in these laborers' households, of the laborer, the men would get drunk, they would beat them and subject them to sexual violence. So it was both, right, a feminist thing and a moralistic thing. And we see that throughout history. But I think you see that with every social movement throughout history. There are strange bedfellows, there are alliances, there are activists that have to make choices, right, strategic choices, with so many moving parts and imperfect information. And that's true of feminists, right? And so I'm not saying feminists acted differently than any other social movement. I'm saying they acted the same. We have to understand that feminist criminal law reforms always took place in the context of larger hierarchies, from slavery, right, to social purity, to sex panic, right? They have always had synergies with these phenomena that people today look back on and say are so retrograde, right? The anti-pornography movement also aligned with anti-LGBTQ, right? So it was the gay bookstores that were getting raided as a method of stamping down on that sexual minority. So yes, you know, feminists have made these choices and have at times allied with extremely illiberal forces. That's true of many movement groups. But I mean, you know, I wasn't looking at many movement groups. I was looking at feminists and the sort of like tough on crime, crime control, you know, Reagan era, you know, Willie Horton type of thinking. Feminists found a lot of support within that political sphere, which is now a political sphere that everyone's apologizing for. I mean, Joe Biden and Bill Clinton have been on a 5-year-long apology tour for the 1994 Clinton crime bill. Well, a big part of that crime bill was the Violence Against Women Act, the signature federal act of feminism, right? So there's always been these alliances, but they were particularly pronounced during the birth of the first wave of feminism, right? Right before the turn of the century. In the birth of the second wave of feminism, which was the late 70s going into the 80s, they were two pretty pronounced alliances with conservative movements.
And I guess, where would you pinpoint the start of this sort of carceral feminism?
Well, carceral feminism is a term that was coined by a sociologist. Her name is Elizabeth Bernstein, around 2007. And she was really using it to describe how this dominance feminism, right, this form of dominance feminism where sexual subordination is the key to all women's lowered status, was being exported in the international sphere. Such that, like in the international and transnational sphere, people who were concerned about the, you know, lived reality of people engaged in commercial sex and sex work, you know, also called prostitution, you know, that they were increasingly turning to criminal and quasi-criminal models for addressing what many would consider to be a material conditions issue. Right, or surviving by committing a crime, but that's only a crime because you're in an unregulated labor market. Like, so the left thinking on this would be, you know, labor protection services, you know, figuring out the capital flows and how to best help women engaged in this work. But it increasingly turned to a criminal model where you either criminalize everybody, right, the people who house the women themselves, the buyers, everybody, or a quasi-criminal model like the Nordic model where you know, the organizers and the buyers, but not the women, but they get sort of the downstream effects of the punishment anyway. And so what she was saying was this drift, right, from using the welfare apparatus, right, to address women's material conditions to using the criminal apparatus happened in the latter 20th century. So we're talking like 1980s on. So really this second wave phenomenon. So that's where the person who coined the term carceral feminism saw the origins in it. And it is true that feminism did take this really, really pronounced carceral turn in the latter 19th century. But from my research, it's not because, you know, feminists all of a sudden got carceral, it's because feminists all of a sudden got very active, right? And then there was this carceral apparatus and they just sort of went together, at least in the United States, without feminists really ever fully pursuing the economic models, the racial equality models, the welfare rights models. It went carceral pretty quickly off the bat. And then the first movement of feminism back, you know, the suffrage movement, the temperance movements, you know, they were more or less carceral when they were dealing with sexual violence and drunkenness. They used the tool of the state. But back then, there wasn't really a carceral state. There was very little policing. And in fact, when you look at the role of feminists and, you know, vice crusaders, they were really instrumental in creating federal police forces and creating, you know, surveillance systems. So at the two important moments where feminism was sort of being born, right, and reborn, you see these carceral alliances, and I would call it less even like a turn from a different model of feminism to carceralism as, you know, a certain dominant group of feminists and feminists within, you know, the larger, more diverse group of feminists embracing carcerality because it's there and it's a big institution. And then that sort of taking over as the meaning of feminism, that sort of being, in retrospect, has to a large extent defined feminism, just as feminism to a large extent through, you know, centering victims and seeing criminal law as a tool of equality and justice has shaped American perceptions of the criminal system. So I would say it's like less of a 20th century turn than understanding the tendency of powerful feminist groups at these two critical moments to embrace the governance tool of criminal law.
What, to play devil's advocate, what is the problem with taking up that governance tool? Do you have any examples that show, oh, maybe this isn't the way to go?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of problems with taking up that governance tool because we you know, have a sense that criminal law could be like any other tool of governance. And, you know, frankly, civil law, they're all pretty complicated. They all have complicated costs and benefits. But criminal law is a particularly costly tool of governance, right? I mean, you are putting bodies in cages, right? You are using armed officers. It comes with these inbuilt costs, right? So this idea of leaping to criminal law as a first resort, you know, that's somehow natural, is really odd to me. And I think that we think criminal law as natural because that has been in the United States for so long the way you send moral messages, right? If you want to say a practice is unacceptable, you throw some criminal law at it. And, you know, that's not actually true of other countries or even, you know, maybe certain points of time in this country. So that's one thing.
Not to interrupt you.
Yeah.
But it's interesting because I've talked to people from other countries on, you know, issues related to crime and law. And I notice a lot more people in, say, Britain or certain European countries will say that they are more for truth and reconciliation rather than really punitive measures. So, yeah, I think there are a lot of differences between America and the rest of the world in some ways.
Yeah, and so if you look at that Reagan 80s moment, it was a massive moment of restructuring the moral sensibilities of the populace, right? So you're restructuring them towards, again, neoliberalism, this idea that the pursuit of capital, right, is a positive character trait. So that if you're not rich, it's you're failing and you're immoral and you haven't done something right, you're lazy. And it was also an idea of deregulation, right? Like, so taking the government out of many spaces, right? But if you look around you and you see all these problems and you're taking the government out of the space because you're deregulating market actors, well, what do you do with the problem? Well, you say, oh, you know what the problem is? It's the problem of these lazy people. It's lazy men of color, mostly, right? And also deviants. These are the two groups, you know, monstrous deviants and sort of the scary super predator young men of color. These are the people causing the problem, and we'll throw criminal law at them, right? And so it was a really intentional neoliberal move to say, let's put criminal law in the space. And here's the moral language we're gonna use for it. We're gonna describe and show you tons of images of vulnerable children and white women subjected to horrific abuse. And then we're gonna say the way to deal with it is to give really long, harsh, you know, sentences and summary procedures to the perpetrators. If you disagree with me about that, you must be pro-crime, right? You must be on their side. So that, you know, so that was an engineered impulse, right? And then it became an impulse. What do you do to deal with bad actors? You prosecute them, right? You put them in jail. So that was a very deliberate sort of discourse. And I think, you know, to some extent, feminism was influenced by it. And to some extent, feminists influenced that discourse because they had long been sort of concentrating on victims and prioritizing, you know, victims and images of brutalized women within the system, right? So, yeah, I just think that that's definitely a connection that, you know, was deeply American. You know, also, you know, Thatcherism had something to do with that and making England a more crime control state. And it seeped out. I do think, you know, since the United States has had these wars on crime, which really reached a pinnacle in the 90s, you know, other countries have also seen increases in their rates of punitivity following sort of the American lead, but nowhere near to the level of the United States. Even though crime rates in other countries are comparable to the United States, and they've always been, you know, we had just embraced this notion of prosecution as the compelled moral solution. And so think about it from feminism then. Why did feminists do it? Well, take domestic violence, for example. If you define violence against women, the problem of violence against women and women's inequality as, quote, society and the law not taking domestic violence seriously, right? Like if that's how you define it, and then you further define taking something seriously as prosecuting someone, prosecuting, you know, right, arresting and prosecuting domestic violence cases is thereby, by definition, an act of gender justice. And it doesn't matter if it causes more harm or good. You already achieved it. You don't even have to look at the results. And that was, in fact, a mentality that was very prevalent. That, look, it says something about our society that abusers get away with it. It says we don't value women. So if you don't let abusers get away with it, if you quote unquote throw the book at them, then we value women. And that is in itself an achievement, right? And so when pretty early on in this domestic violence prosecution system, which involved sort of these policies that required the police to arrest, required prosecutors to prosecute, you know, required DV being taken seriously. Pretty early on in the process, sociological studies were revealing that arrest, right, this mandatory arrest and involvement in the criminal system could actually increase the violence against women, and especially poor women of color. And, you know, basically, during a tough on crime era, this was all in the 80s and early 90s, legislatures were falling over themselves. Police departments were falling over themselves to adopt these tough on crime policies. It completely aligned with their interests. So what happened was we've got all these policies. Now the sociological evidence is coming in that these aren't particularly good for women. They're increasing arrests of women by, for example, in California, 400%. They are increasing violence against women of color. Women of color and at-risk women are becoming afraid to call for help just for temporary intervention and putting themselves at higher risk of homicide. Like, these aren't having desired effects. They're criminogenic, and they're actually not benefiting a lot of women. you know, feminists were really in a conundrum then because they had defined the law enforcement response as gender justice. So a lot of them just doubled down on it. And they said, you know, I want to, you know, one quote that I sort of have repeated was a 1992 quote by a feminist who said, look, the answer in these poor communities of color that, you know, when arrest is escalating the violence is to get tougher on these unemployed black men. Right? Because people in the ghettos, and that's the word that she had used, you know, a few hours in jail is nothing for them. So this really, really dehumanizing sort of rhetoric about how, you know, to black people, you know, arrest and jailing is nothing. I mean, you find feminists engaging on that rhetoric because they had painted themselves into this law enforcement alliance.
It reminds me of that. I was going to say real quickly, it reminds me of that Hillary Clinton line, they're super predators. We have to bring them to Hill, you know.
That's right. I mean, and so she got so much flack for the super predator when she was running against, you know, in the primaries against Bernie Sanders and then running against Trump. They said, well, you know, Hillary Clinton was Miss Super Predator. But everybody, every good Democrat was super predator then. Why? Because it was a deliberate Democratic strategy, right? When Dukakis lost horribly to Bush, to H.W. Bush, Democrats actually feared the Hortonizing of the entire Democratic Party. So I was reading an article on this and researching my book. There was something that insiders called the Biden-Schumer strategy. And the Biden-Schumer strategy was to make Democrats, the party of crime control, so that they could win the election. And in fact, Bill Clinton, you know, did campaign on being the tough on crime candidate, and they were able to successfully change public opinion so that by the time that Clinton was elected, the public thought that Democrats were equally as tough on crime as Republicans. And part of that signature effort was Biden's drafting of the 1994 crime bill, which he had drafted in other iterations since 1991. And, you know, your listeners probably have heard of the 1994 crime bill because, you know, it is blamed for mass incarceration. It did amazing things. It took money away from federal programs, and Biden boasted about this, so you could put 100,000 officers, more officers on the street, build 100,000 more jail cells, three strikes laws, eliminating parole, mandatory minimum, 60 new death penalty offenses. And importantly, as Clinton recognized in 2015 when he spoke to the NAACP, it set the tone for states to follow. So yes, I mean, it was a huge ingredient in our outlier, most punitive nation status. Now, the interesting part about it is that Hillary Clinton got a ton of flack for super predators and her connection to it, but Bernie didn't. And Bernie voted for the crime control bill. Okay. Now, he was in the House then, and he actually spoke out pretty vociferously against the bill. He said, you know, this is not the way to go. We can electrocute or we can educate, we can give people jobs or we can throw them in jail. But yet he voted for the bill. And why did he vote for the bill? Well, part of that bill was the Violence Against Women Act, which Clinton was touting as a brilliant part of that bill, right? Because it was tough on crime and it protected women, okay? And it was also liberal in the sense that it was pro-women. Now, we had the O.J. Simpson trial, you know, just occur. And so people took to the floor of Congress and the Senate to say, like, you know, how many more women have to die like Nicole Brown Simpson, which also brought into play some, you know, racial aspects. And so that Violence Against Women Act and the assault weapons ban, which was in the crime control bill, was enough to make Bernie Sanders, you know, a huge critic of the bill, vote for the bill, three strikes and all. And when he was challenged during his, you know, primary bid against Hillary Clinton about his vote for the bill, his campaign released a statement and said he totally disagreed with the, quote, mass incarceration portions of the bill, but he did it, quote, to protect women.
You know, I want to take this into a direction that I haven't heard you talk about before, although mm-hmm. I know you mention it in the book. And, you know, we were talking about the feminist sort of civil war and the story of feminism. One group that you mention in the book that I don't really hear discussed a lot is the Combahee River Collective. What do you think the role of the River Collective is within, you know, the story of feminism and the sort of debates within feminism itself? Because I think they're a good example of how feminism isn't monolithic.
Absolutely. So the Combahee River Collective were Black feminists. And they were exactly the ones I was talking about before who said, you know, we can't completely imagine a separatist world, you know, divorced from men. So this was part of that now sort of like women calling a very radical idea, right? That women could sort of be responsible for their own healthcare, their own economics. And they said, you know, we can't completely divorce from men because even though as Black women, we struggle against the patriarchy and Black men's participation in the patriarchy. We also struggle against white supremacy, and we struggle with Black men, right, in a way that white women don't have to be allied with white men unless their alliance is just to further white supremacy, right? So if you're a liberal white woman, you don't really have a need to see men as your ally in the struggle against patriarchy. And then you don't have any other real common struggles. At least this was the argument, right? Because what would the race struggle be? You both want to be white supremacists? No, you're like a liberal feminist woman. You don't want to be a white supremacist. But Black women have, you know, Black progressive women have, you know, two important hierarchies that we struggle against. And we're not willing to give up on the struggle against racism. Like, we're just not willing. And so it's interesting because from the beginning, Black feminists did not prioritize either separatism, right? This idea of women separately competing in the market, getting a leg up in the market, nor did they prioritize criminal law. This idea of sort of prosecuting and jailing enough men where the patriarchy is reversed and women can get power. Really what you had was a lot of Black feminists engaged in the welfare rights movement. So for example, Johnny Tillman, a Black feminist, she was president of the National Organization for Welfare Rights, right? Which was really a grassroots, like pro-labor, a pro, you know, social safety net type of organization. And they really had a tricky alliance with the National Organization of Women that were all about sort of market power and women competing in the workplace. Well, welfare, you know, and the idea that women should be able to choose to stay home and should have economic security, that they could do that, that was really not consonant with the sort of mainstream get out and work, you know, which was interesting because it led Toni Morrison to say, like, if our Black grandmas, you know, have to do the childcare in the home so that you white women can go work, you know, and be important, something's seriously wrong with this movement, right? So from the beginning, you know, the movement was really focused on sort of material needs and meeting women where they were at, right? And not this carceral sort of market perception. And, you know, they faced a challenge with this sort of Main Street white feminists who were all about getting women out of these abusive marriages and, in fact, out of the home into the workplace and jailing the men, right, as part of this sort of separation ethic. And so Black feminists warned, you know, if you come into our neighborhoods and jail the men, right, this is going to be a problem. Because first of all, the police don't have a problem with jailing our women in the way, you know, white women are completely immune to policing, right? So you're putting Black women at risk this way. And we're not so simpatico with jailing the men because you're jailing them within a racist institution which was built around the premise of keeping African Americans in slave-like conditions. So this was being said, right? It just didn't get a lot of momentum, right? It just wasn't getting a lot of play, because even the very radical and sympathetic and left-leaning white feminists in the domestic violence shelter movement were becoming more welcoming to the police, because they were shelters and they could use the police as free security. And the police were a lot nicer to women once they said, oh, this woman took it upon herself to leave the man and call in the police, right? Then they were with women when they came to the home and the woman was like, I'm not sure you want to arrest him. You know, I'll arrest both of you, right? So, you know, that tide was just turning, and it was turning at a time when the government was really reluctant to give federal grants to services, to shelters, to the services women needed, because it was anti-welfare. It was work to welfare, right? But like things that would separate women and get them in the capitalist marketplace, and things that would, you know, grow the penal state, and the rhetoric, the carceral rhetoric of the penal state, those two things were getting a lot of play. So it's not that there were no dissenting voices. There were dissenting voices from the beginning. They just were kind of swept away as the rising tide went towards policing, prosecution, and punishment.
The other reason I asked about the River Collective was because when I told, I actually told a Pierre Bourdieu scholar, a sociologist friend of mine, that I was interviewing you, and he said, oh, she talks about neo-feminism, but isn't she saying the same thing that the River Collective and people before her were saying? And I just want you to comment on that, maybe. What do you mean by neo-feminism? Do you think you take from past traditions with that, or?
Yeah, so I've often been asked a similar, so I thought the Bourdieu scholar was going to take me to task for using the prefix neo, you know, like neoliberal, neo-Nazi. And there are some good things with neo in front, and not just like Keanu Reeves neo, like neo-soul movement, neo-constitutionalism, whatever. But anyway, so I have been often asked, you know, whether this is all just the story of white versus black feminism. And it's interesting because when I started writing on, you know, the feminist alliance with criminal law, you know, the first feminist war on crime was an article I wrote in 06 about domestic violence, and I used that same title for this. But, you know, I started writing about this alliance back in 1997, and you didn't hear the term, quote unquote, white feminism as much. I mean, you knew that there was a racial rift within feminism. That's always been obvious. But it's only in more recent years that a lot of the pathologies that you know, are within the broader feminist movement, or a lot of the strange bedfellow bad alliances, are now being sort of just called a problem of white feminism. And so I would say that race is deeply embedded in the pathologies of feminism that I am identifying. Race is deeply embedded in it, but it's not the whole story. Right.
Is that where you would differentiate between, say, the River Collective and what you're sort of pointing towards with alternatives to the system we have now with regards to feminism?
So I would say neo-feminism is more like a critical theory than an identity-based theory, right? So I would say what neo-feminism would say to do is recognize that, yeah, there are subordinated identities. I'm not anti-identitarian. I do identify as a feminist. I also identify as a critical race scholar. I think that identity-based, you know, claims of subordination are completely right and valid, but so are other claims of subordination, right? Material, economic, political, like all of these are part of the mix. And I think what we have to do as feminists is realize we do have women's subordination and these sites of women's subordination, but women have intersecting identities, right? And that's true on the racial front, right? They may be Black women, they may be Latina women, Asian women, and these intersecting identities will change the way that criminal law and policy, or even all law and policy, affect them vis-a-vis, say, a white woman. But even within the category of white women, we have lots of diversity there. For example, a very easy one is socioeconomic diversity. We have age ranges, right? And depending on your age, you may have different reactions to what is a sexual harm or not, right? So basically what I'm saying is these are complex issues that not only require us to think intersectionally, but require us to do these really complex framing analyses about whether to use law, how to understand the problem at issue. And then if we decide to use law, don't just say, oh, because I'm throwing law at the problem of rape, I've now dealt with the problem of rape. The law you put out in the world, right, and this was true of the domestic violence mandatory arrest policing, might have the exact opposite effect of what you intended. So basically, I'm saying to feminists, be accountable to how you frame the problem, who you imagine as the beneficiaries of your law or policy proposals, right? And then try as best as you can to be accountable to the costs of this proposal, not just accountable to what you hope and think that this proposal will work, but accountable to how the proposal will operate in the real world. And we live in a real world of supreme inequality and mass incarceration.
Before we close out, if you have time, I know before we started recording, you mentioned that you haven't been asked much about Title IX and the sections in your book on sex trafficking. I don't know which of those you want to tackle first, but I wanted to tackle them if we could for a little bit.
Yeah, and I think that the reason I'm being asked about policing, you know, in the domestic violence space more is that people are, you know, rightly extremely interested in and concerned about policing, and they're concerned about what happens when you depolice in an area of gender justice, right? So, you know, I mean, what can I say except that Title IX and sex trafficking, they're all a piece of this idea that the remedy to women's subordination is more criminal law. And I guess I'll use my time to tell a sex trafficking story because I think it resonates with a lot of current themes. At the end of the 19th century, one of the big sort of feminist crusades was the anti, quote unquote, white slavery crusade, right? So once, you know, the enslavement of Black Americans was, you know, officially abolished, a lot of the feminists that had worked in the slavery abolition movement were very receptive to a rhetoric of new slavery. And this was a slavery of women being bought and sold into prostitution. And it was a highly racialized narrative from the beginning. In fact, the first inklings of it were out of England in the 1830s, were sort of journalists writing about, you know, Jewish and other ethnic men who trapped white girls, white European girls, in their dens of iniquity, right? So that's kind of a den of iniquity. And in the United States, it was often imagined as these sort of lower class and ethnic thugs enticing, you know, nice Christian girls into prostitution. So that was sort of the rhetoric of white slavery. And we had to save these girls from utter ruination, because prostitution was, quote, right, and this is what you know, the politician who passed the Mann Act, who was the White Slavery Act, said, was, quote, that was worse than, quote, any slavery that Uncle Tom had ever heard of, right? You had other, you know, anti-white slavery activists saying that compared to the lives that prostitutes live, African slavery is, quote, a beneficent captivity, right? Like, so this was like the rhetoric they were using. Well, on the West Coast, the anti-sex slavery movement had a real eugenicist and racist bent. So right in the swing of the Chinese population of California nearing like 25%, you know, there were these fears of the yellow peril. And within that, you started to hear a lot of rhetoric about yellow slavery and the enslaved Chinese women. And it was very interesting because their rhetoric was that, unlike white women who are kept in bondage, what's particularly pernicious about Asian, you know, Chinese sex work is that the women are inculcated and innately coolies, right? They're sexual coolies. They just live in this, you know, utterly foreign and disgusting, morally abandoned culture where they're inculcated to sexual slavery. And every means needs to be used to eradicate this noxious practice. In fact, the founder of the University of California Medical College at the time, Hugh Toland, said in 1876 that, you know, China women were spreading diseases and they were the causes of syphilis. And the American Medical Association actually commissioned a study on whether Asian women were poisoning Americans' blood. So within this very racist, but also feminist, because the Christian Temperance Union was rescuing, right, these enslaved women from their fate that was worse than death. You know, so within all this, we had the very first federal anti-immigration act called the Page Act. And the Page Act excluded from entry, and it was the very first federal legislation to do it, excluded from entry in 1876, quote, debauched women. And it was directed directly towards this tiny little population of Chinese women in California. But what it necessitated was a whole infrastructure, right, of immigration surveillance and enforcement that has now become ICE. So racist and feminist sensibility lay behind it. And what's so incredible is that in the last 10 years, we've seen ramped up rhetoric about sex slavery. But even from President Obama in 2012, he was like, I imagine my daughters, you know, being captured into slavery. And often this rhetoric ends up at policies directed pretty intentionally against Asian women, right? And so we have this phenomenon where in 2009 in Rhode Island, due to a sex workers' rights lawsuit back in the 80s, right, it, quote unquote, indoor sex work had been decriminalized. So you couldn't go out and solicit for prostitution. You couldn't house, you know, sex workers. You couldn't be like a pimp or a panderer. But you could engage in a sexual transaction indoors, and it wasn't a crime. Right? So, you know, this had driven the churches crazy in Rhode Island and a lot of the businesses, right, who didn't want to see massage parlors in downtown Rhode Island. It had driven those communities crazy, but they could never get the political traction to recriminalize indoor prostitution because it always ran up against civil libertarians like the ACLU. And liberal sensibilities and a democratic state legislature. That is until 2009, when a women's studies professor framed the issue of indoor prostitution as the issue of sex slavery, sex trafficking, and women's human rights. And she was able to sponsor a legislative package with those same strange, you know, bedfellows, the community Christian law enforcement bedfellows, to recriminalize the act of indoor prostitution. And on the eve of the legislative vote, sex workers, many using interpreters, all Asian, came in begging them not to pass this law begging them not to criminalize what they did, or at least giving them a little more time so they could put their kids through school. But because of the feminist bent of this, indoor prostitution was recriminalized, and it just put an even broader stamp of approval on the very, like, I just want to say, sexist and horrific police raids that were going on, that the police were calling calling things like, quote, Operation Rubdown, where they would go, and the sexist and demeaning things they would say. In Florida, where the famous Robert Kraft Orchids of Asia, you know, raid happened.
Cindy Yang, yeah.
Right. They put a camera in there and were filming these women in real time. And guess what? All the men got their charges dropped against them, but the women who owned the spa were facing tons of charges. They got all their assets seized. Well, in Florida, the police there called that massage parlor, you know, sex work trade, the quote, standard Asian model. And they would name these operations things like Operation Gilded Cage, the largest operation ever in sex interdiction trafficking was in California in 2005. It was this Operation Gilded Cage, where a 400-person police force descended on massage parlors. And the neighbors in town, who were mostly Korean, said it looked like they were going after Osama bin Laden. And they arrested hundreds of sex workers, deported many of them, and even kept a few of them on material witness warrants and force them to testify against the owners. So what you see is this parallel history of the sort of racialized narratives, moralistic instinct, and these feminist programs really pushing the law and order agenda. And you say, okay, well, what's changed from 1876 then, you know, in California to 2020? And so I think that just shows that, you know, the claim of protecting women's and women's rights is an important claim, but it's also a powerful claim that, if allied with criminal law, has the effect of not just making feminism carceral, but really legitimizing and growing a penal state that people are increasingly seeing as unconscionable.
In other words, it can be weaponized against it can be weaponized for use to oppress people.
Right. I mean, anything can be weaponized for good or ill, right? And so certainly if criminal law is a formidable weapon, you know, it's natural to think maybe I could use this as a tool to achieve justice, whether racial, socioeconomic. I'll criminalize whoever the real bad guys are. And everybody has in your, whether you're on the left, whether you're on the right, has the real bad guys, real victim image in their head. But the problem with criminal law and using that particular weapon is it is embedded in a history, right, that is very hard to disentangle it from. It has its own logic, its entrenched players, even its own economies. And the idea that you will be able, in a relatively cost-free way, to invoke this massive and not just technocratic, but moralistic system, right? In order to achieve whatever it is the goal you have in your mind is, while minimizing the damage this system otherwise does, is just very unlikely. So one of the things that I sort of propose as a tenet of modern feminism or neo-feminism is that really the tool of criminal law, the technique of criminal logic, should be a tool and technique of last resort. Maybe never resort. Maybe you'll never get there, because once we try other things and realize that they work a lot better, maybe we'll never get there. But it is this automatic tendency when we look at harms, and especially harms that implicate hierarchies and inequalities in society, and think that throwing criminal law enforcement and punishment at those harms is like the natural way to go or the exclusive way to go. I just, like, my main goal, if it can be anything, is being, you know, one more voice in a growing chorus that we should not link our noble, you know, gender justice goals to strengthening that criminal apparatus that feminists can't control. You know, they have not been able to control the pathologies of it.
You know, I guess in closing, what is it that you would like folks to get out of not only this conversation, but also your book? And I guess, you know, do you find it odd at all when people view your book as trying to bait controversy? Because I think you're actually engaged in a pretty honest sort of discussion here. I don't think it's just about, you know, riling people up.
Yeah, and I think that, like, the feminist war on crime, you know, I didn't, like I said, so first of all, it was an article title, so I just kind of recycled it. But it wasn't meant to, you know, say, like, you know, maybe if I said the feminist incarcerators, you know, but it was really meant to say there are these two phenomena that people are pretty familiar with from the, mostly from the latter 20th century, right? I do go back farther than that, not in my article, but in my book. But the war on crime, people are familiar with what the war on crime is, and people are familiar with second wave feminism, or at least, you know, they have some idea of what it is. But what they haven't understood is how closely these two things have been linked, right? And so that's why, you know, the second part of it, originally the publisher wanted me to say the unintentional role of women's liberation in mass incarceration. But I told them I couldn't do it because it's more complex than being a co-opted, right, or weaponized by right-wing prosecutors or savvy politicians. It was this really very complex symbiotic relationship where feminists sometimes use criminal law, criminal actors sometimes use feminists, feminists sometimes defined criminal law in a space, and vice versa. And where, you know, feminism really did use this tool of criminal law to produce a lot of justice for individual women. But at the same time, it produced a lot of hardship for individual women and did other things. So really what I tried to do was describe this very complex and understudied, right, under-discussed relationship of feminism to policing, prosecution and punishment throughout the ages. So that was the first goal. I wanted to discuss it. And it's interesting because yesterday I just wrote a Slate article that came out talking a little bit about that history of domestic violence policing. And people are like, I didn't know that. Right. And I didn't know that. I had written on the domestic violence court without knowing the full history for years. Right. I just had instincts and folk knowledge. So that was the first thing. I wanted to really examine this complex relationship between feminism and, you know, what we've been calling the carceral state. And the second goal was more normative. And it was really inspired by the campus rape crisis and how everybody was like, you know, everyone's getting raped on campus and it's just a hunting ground and women are victims. And we've really got to broaden definitions of this, of what is sexual misconduct and the kind of sex we want the government to regulate. And then the Me Too movement, which was in part, you know, confess your victimhood in order to be part of this movement and be, you know, very punitive in order to be part of this movement. So part of it was to speak to what I call in the book millennial feminists, who are probably really more Gen Zers, but millennial feminists who are torn by these two competing intuitions, which is to not, you know, use the blunt tool of criminal law and always be so punitive, to realize and understand that all these top-down carceral or even bureaucratic disciplinary systems are really rife with racial discrimination and other problems. So they have this one sort of anti-mass incarceration instinct, and then they have this other really punitive Me Too campus rape crisis instinct. And it was really to speak to them and say, you know, you can take the great parts of Me Too, the parts where you do confess to victimhood and say, that's okay, right? It's not my fault. It's not something I should be embarrassed of. You can demand cultural change. We've got to be more thoughtful about the way we approach sexual relationships, the way we understand men and women's relationship to sex, and whether, you know, men have to be, you know, sexual aggressors and women have to be gatekeepers. We really can understand that women suffer sort of everyday microaggressions that make it hard sometimes to function. And these could be like the catcalling on the street. We can understand and really shed a light on all those things without having to think twice about whether disciplining, prosecution, and punishment are the answers to them. Because I know a lot of feminists who are, they're public defenders. They are in that struggle every day. They're like, well, look, I want to defund the police, but what about rape? You know, but what about domestic violence? What I'm saying to them is, look at the information I've given you on policing and rape and policing and domestic violence and the carceral system. The what about questions can be easily answered. What about the rape and domestic violence? We should be doing other things than throwing money at policing, prosecution, and incarceration. So what I want to say to the sort of millennial feminists through an understanding of history is, you can put all this great feminist energy, right, this political energy towards things that both shrink the carceral state and produce gender justice without feeling like you are a rape apologist, right? And I understand why they feel that way, because if you've been a critic of the domestic violence criminal system and the sexual violence penal system for as long as I have, you've been called a rape apologist many times, right? You've been called somebody who sympathizes with monsters and on the side of monsters. Nowadays, people can just say, well, look, I'm anti-incarceration. I'm Black Lives Matter, right? I'm not on the side of rapists, but I'm Black Lives Matter. But 15 years ago, you couldn't say that, right? Like you could just say, no, I think you should think more deeply about, you know, prosecution and punishment. So what I'm trying to say to young feminists is, don't worry about that, because not being for maximal prosecution and punishment does not make you anti-feminist, right? It's only if you indulge in the connection that many years of history have conspired to have us indulge in. It's only if you indulge in that connection that you think twice about saying, you know what? I've identified an area of gender violence, but what I'm not going to do is call for more criminal law.
Well, I guess I would say in that regard, and I want to let you going. I've kept you a little bit over. Have you gotten any pushback from people that are sort of misinterpreting the book? Because I guess that really interests me. That there's probably people out there saying, "Oh, she's trying to undermine feminism completely." Or I told a friend of mine who votes Republican. They said, "Oh, the feminist war on women. It's going to be an anti-feminist book. I like that." Like, I don't think it's going to be what you think it is. Have you had people misinterpret the book and then read it and come out different?
I have actually had people, maybe not completely misinterpret it, that it was like a, you know, feminist war on boys, or, you know, who stole feminism, which, you know, maybe have like a little bit more of the right wing leanings than I certainly do. I am not anti-identitarian. I don't think social justice is a bad word. I think it's like a bad phrase. I think it's a good word. I like, you know, Black Lives Matter. I like feminists. I like, in many ways, Me Too. You know, I did have the very first Amazon review, and I just know this because it was the very first one before the book was released, was somebody who hadn't read the book. And they gave it like a 1-star review saying, you know, I haven't read this book, but if it says that feminists are solely responsible for mass incarceration, I'm not going to like it. You know, and I guess my answer is, read the book, because I think if it was going to say that, it would be entitled, you know, How Feminism Caused Mass Incarceration, right? And what I'm saying is, there is an unexpected connection, and one that I think is very important for us to understand. I mean, feminists did engage at many different points throughout history in their own war on crime, and participated on the larger, more conservative war on crime. And when we understand those moments, for example, you know, I talk a lot about you know, the claims of rapes of white women in the Reconstruction era South, and how that was used, right? Like to justify lynching, and how it was used as a tool to keep African Americans in enslaved like conditions, and how many tools of criminal law were used, aided and abetted by white women. And if you understand sort of feminist conundrum in there, I tell a story where one of the feminist temperance activists was dressed down by Ida B. Wells, right, for stirring up the lynch mob when she was on a feminist rape reform kick, you know, but she was stirring up the Southerners to think that rape was a bestial act. And of course, what did they think of when they thought a bestial act? That just fed into the narrative. And the interesting thing about Frances Willard, who was the temperance activist who was doing these rape reforms, was she accused Ida Wells of being anti-woman because Ida Wells was accusing white women of being liars and making up rapes. So you see this tension, right? This race, you know, feminist believe women tension going on in 1896. And I think that's, you know, and who do I think had the better of the argument? I think Ida Wells did, and you know, can read the book to see why, but I think there was far more at stake there. And the age of consent movement that the feminists were on the side of was tending to jail a lot of women for underage sex. So, you know, I think Ida Wells had the better of it. But if you understand the parameters of what went on back then, I mean, it puts, you know, the debate between, you know, Me Too and putting rapists in jail and the fact that there is this racial narrative of rape and this racial reality of jailing, you know, it gives you so much perspective on that debate. So that's really what I'm trying to do is have people understand these carceral turns that have gone on, you know, in very powerful segments of feminism throughout time, to understand where, if they're like me, their own instincts, you know, about feminism's necessarily carceral nature come from. And I would say to people who think I'm just writing a provocative, you know, stick it to feminists book.
You come off as pretty good faith to me. I want to say that first, but go on.
Yeah. But I mean, I who thinks so from the title, and I didn't, you know, I didn't think I wrote the description that way, but you know, the title and the description are also partially like to, you know, to get people interested in the book. But I would say that, you know, like nowhere do either of those things say that feminism is a bad movement or anything like that. So I would encourage them to read it. I think if they're interested in the topic of feminism and mass incarceration enough to have strong feelings on the title, they'd probably be interested in what the book has to say. And so, you know, I hope they read it. I hope they're not sort of turned off and thinking that it's something it's not, because I try to be, you know, generous to feminists, you know, which I consider myself one. And I know that there are feminist activists who think I'm wrong, right? That think that I've got it all wrong. And I've, you know, and there's more of a story where criminal law has worked, or more of the mainstream feminists were against it. And they could, you know, they could think I'm wrong. And I have no problem with people thinking I'm wrong. But I do have a problem with people thinking I said something I didn't say and then not finding out whether I said it, right? And you know, I'll take the blame if the title is too strong. I didn't think it was. Yeah.
Well, like I said, I think it's a very good faith argument being made. Then again, I mean, I guess I'm a dude. I don't know if I can speak to that. It seemed very good faith. Based on my intuitions about it, you were very generous, even to the people that you may disagree with throughout the book. And I really appreciated that in this time where I think a lot of people give into bad faith arguments. And I haven't seen you do that in the book or in your interviews. So I appreciate that. And I want to thank you for coming on Parallax Views.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed and found rather enlightening my conversation with Aya Gruber, author of The Feminist War on Crime, The Unexpected Role of Women's Liberation in Mass Incarceration, available now from the University of California Press. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@protonmail.com. And of course, if you can, please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/ParallaxViews. Thanks to my $10 tier Patreon supporters, including Amelia, Martin, Mark, and Gary Brescher. Yes, that Gary Brescher from Radio War Nerd. They all get a producer's credit as part of my $10 tier on Patreon.com. It is those Patreon listeners I just mentioned, along with others who are helping to financially bolster my efforts to produce this show, that keep Parallax Views going. So many thanks to all my Patreon supporters. And again, if you'd like to join those listeners in supporting me on Patreon, you can do so at patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. If nothing else, if we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.